This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Mizmor le David Adonai ro'i lo echsar binodesh yar bitzeni.
That's Rabbi Lauren Holzblatt presiding over a small service for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg today, just before her body was placed in repose at the United States Supreme Court. Her death has sparked an outpouring of emotion and respect for her legacy, and also a fierce standoff over who will appoint her successor. Here's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking yesterday on the Senate floor.
Ruth Ginsburg was a woman who never let any man silence her. The most fitting tribute to her is to refuse to be silenced and to name exactly what Donald Trump and Senate Republicans are trying to do: steal another Supreme Court seat.
Here to discuss this political fight and how it's playing out here in Massachusetts is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Anthony, our senators have been active on this subject in the last few days. We heard Elizabeth Warren just there. What has Senator Ed Markey been saying?
Well, much of the same kinds of things. I mean, he says that Senate Leader Mitch McConnell should follow the precedent that he set back in 2016 when he wouldn't consider Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. McConnell said that let the election take place first because we were so close to election. So on Sunday, Markey said that's what McConnell should do now. And he told progressive organizers and activists that blocking Trump's ability to add another conservative to the court is pretty important. Here's a bit of what he said.
Think about it. This Supreme Court justice might, in fact, vote on whether or not Donald Trump gets seated, perhaps in a 5-4 vote, as fraudulent activity is engaged in.
And Tiziana, that's not a fantasy, because recall that back in 2000, a 5-4 Supreme Court decision ended the contested presidential election in favor of George W. Bush. And Markey went further, tweeting that if Democrats regain power, they should abolish the filibuster and expand the Supreme Court.
Okay, so those are strong statements. Those are strong claims. What does it mean for him to suggest that, and how are other Democrats reacting to it?
Well, it's interesting. Elizabeth Warren, by the way, has also said packing the court is an idea worth considering. Outgoing Congressman Joe Kennedy said if McConnell holds a vote in 2020, we pack the court in 2021. It's that simple. So what it means is this. It means passing a law that would expand the number of Supreme Court justices. The Constitution doesn't say anything about how many justices have to be on the court, so all it takes is a law. And if Democrats win the White House and the Senate, they could do that. But not everybody thinks it's a good idea. Joe Biden hasn't embraced it, and the Washington Post reported recently that member of his team didn't like that Markey was pushing the idea. And the concern there is that it might push too far and mess with tradition. And Biden, being a senator of many decades, is a traditionalist. And by the way, we know that Ruth Bader Ginsburg thought packing the court was a bad idea because she thought it would further politicize the court.
So much of this is about what the Republicans are going to do, Anthony. What are Republican reactions here in the Commonwealth?
Well, interesting. So here in Massachusetts, Republican Attorney Kevin O'Connor, who's challenging Senator Ed Markey in November, is pretty blunt about what the U.S. Senate should do following the death of Justice Ginsburg. He says they should do their job, which he says means as soon as President Trump nominates a successor, the Senate should hold hearings and vote.
I don't think it's a good idea ever to have an even number of Supreme Court justices. We have a vacancy. There's ample time to conduct an appropriate hearing and to make a decision.
So it's important to note here, though, Tiziana, that O'Connor, of course, wasn't in office in 2016 when the Republican-led Senate refused to consider Barack Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. But O'Connor said he probably would have said the same thing. Now, another prominent Republican in Massachusetts, Governor Baker, is siding with most Democrats on this. He tweeted that the Senate should allow Americans to cast their ballots for president before a new justice is nominated or confirmed. He said the Supreme Court is too important to rush and must be removed from partisan political infighting. That's his hope, but it doesn't appears very unlikely to happen.
And, you know, it's interesting, Anthony, New England Republicans actually are kind of looming large in this battle. Let's start with Maine Senator Susan Collins. She put out a statement saying she opposes taking up the president's nominee to replace Justice Ginsburg, but it didn't say whether she'd vote if the Senate does it. What is her reasoning behind her statement?
Well, I mean, I think the reasoning is explained by, to the extent there is reasoning, it's the fact that she's in the fight of her political life against Sarah Gideon. So I'm sure that has a lot to do with her thinking. I mean, one of the reasons Collins is in such a is in such political trouble with moderates in Maine was because she voted in favor of Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's last Supreme Court pick. So this is a bit of a do-over for her, right? I mean, she seems to be trying to have it both ways, though. She says the Senate can go ahead and start vetting a candidate, but there shouldn't be a vote until after the election. So she seems to be having it, trying to have it both ways here.
So, and then, of course, we have former Massachusetts governor and current Utah Senator Mitt Romney. A lot of people, it seems, were watching him to see what he was going to do. He says he supports President Trump moving forward with a nomination, which I think assures there are enough votes in the Senate, essentially. So I want to know, did that surprise you, especially since Romney has been one of the senators, for example, during impeachment when he actually voted voted to impeach the president, voted against the rest of the Republicans in the Senate?
Right, right. He voted to impeach the president. Yeah, it didn't surprise me. I mean, at the end of the day, Romney is a conservative, and this is a key opportunity for conservative Republicans to push the court to the right. So I'm not really that surprised. I mean, impeachment was different because we were talking about high crimes and misdemeanors of a sitting president. And don't forget that back in 2016, Romney was pretty blunt about what he thought of Donald Trump as a candidate, calling him a phony and a huckster. So, you know, Romney has some principles, but they're conservative principles, and a conservative Supreme Court seems to fit right in line with those principles.
Anthony, voting has already started, at least in some states. So the election's actually happening. Nationally, you know, based on your watching, what side do you think, I know this is a crass question, especially in this moment, but what side do you think benefits politically the most from this fight?
Well, it may be a crass question, but it is a question we all want the answer to.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a really interesting piece in the New York Times yesterday about how in the hours after Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death, Democratic contributions poured in by tens of millions of dollars into Democratic Senate races. At least 13 Democratic candidates or senators raised more than $1.3 million each since Friday from a single fundraising effort. So that suggests that at least initially this is galvanizing Democrats. I mean, consider as well that Democrats can now run on the idea that a more conservative court will very likely overturn Roe versus Wade and the Affordable Care Act, denying health care to tens of millions of Americans. And that issue, health care, worked pretty well for the Democrats in 2018 and could help them again in November. On the other hand, you know, this debate could help Donald Trump appeal to his base and help him change the subject from the pandemic, which most Americans think he has handled pretty terribly. So, you know, I hate to conclude with a cliche, but it remains to be seen. But at least initially, we know it's galvanizing lots of folks on the left. It could do the same to folks on the right.
And Anthony, last question. Do you see any path towards a less politicized Supreme Court in the next decade?
It's such a good question. And, you know, it's a question for a whole hour. I mean, it seems like expanding the court makes sense in many ways. But, you know, I would defer to people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said that's just another way of politicizing. And if Democrats do it a year from now or 2 years from now, then Republicans can do it again. So I honestly don't know the question. I mean, going back to the 2000 election, when we saw a pretty politicized Supreme Court make what a lot of people regard as a terrible decision in Bush v. Gore, I don't know how we get out of this. I really don't. The court isn't what it was, and polls suggest that that's what Americans think now. It's no longer that bedrock institution that everybody has respect for as kind of a nonpartisan arbiter of the law.
Wow. On that note, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, hey, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tiziana.
And we have all heard and seen the recent headlines, a party in Sudbury that delayed the start of in-person schooling.
Classes will be remote for the first 14 days because nearly 50 students went to a party together Friday night.
Parties at Providence College in Rhode Island that have made the surrounding neighborhood an epicenter for COVID-19.
17 students are now suspended as a result of not adhering to the social distancing guidelines that have been promoted not only by city and state officials, but by Providence College as well.
And a wedding in Maine that has led to 8 deaths and hundreds of infections.
Maine health officials are reporting an 8th death tied to a wedding reception last August. Now over 270 coronavirus cases are being traced back to that one super spreader event.
Those sounds courtesy of CNN, NBC Boston, and Channel 5. Now, at face value, one might say, what in the world were they thinking? But 6 months into a pandemic with no end in sight, it is easy to understand why people want to be together and sometimes why they want to celebrate. So we want to get candid about this with you. We're asking you to join this conversation. Have you been to or hosted a party or gathering during the pandemic? And if so, did you take measures to make it safe? If you have been strict about staying home, social distancing, how do you feel seeing others at parties or gatherings? Have you turned down invitations to them because of COVID? What are the safe practices? And is your view of safe practice the same as what the state's is or what your community's is? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet at us at Radio Boston. So joining us for this conversation is Dr. Shira Durone, who is an infectious disease physician and a hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. Durone.
Always good to be with you.
And Beth Titel, a reporter for the Boston Globe. Beth, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks. So great to be with you.
So, Beth, I'm going to start with you. Lots of COVID fatigue. When it comes to gathering, how do you think we think about balancing between civil liberties and the need to be social when it comes to this public safety question, public health question?
Right. I think that's such a good question because what we're really seeing is the importance of the social compact and growing anger when it's violated. I was so interested to hear. I didn't know that an 8th death had been linked to that wedding. It really makes me think about the couple's desire to have a wedding, but the anxiety vortex that sometimes sends guests into. A lot of people who've been invited to weddings now don't want to go, and they're super afraid of going, but they feel like they're like if you RSVP, you're signing your own death warrant. But they also don't want to hurt the couple's feelings. I wrote a story a while ago because I was really thinking about that wedding and how weddings are so surrounded by superstitions, like the groom isn't supposed to see the bride ahead of time in her dress, and if it rains, is it good luck or bad luck? And my God, what about when you start your life together with somebody and now 8 deaths are linked to that event? I interviewed brides who spent their honeymoons just hoping not to hear from contact tracers. So I think that the social compact is so important, and also you can see the pressure on hosts now. Like, how would you possibly host an event worrying not just that people didn't like the food, but they might not even survive?
Well, so that's a stark question, Beth, it's important, right? So let's turn to Dr. Durone. How does one do that? Is there a way to gather safely so that, you know, people do want to, we are a social species. People do want to be together. So once more with feeling, Dr. Durone, how do we gather safely?
So, I mean, it's important to remember that there is never going to be a zero risk situation so long as we're in a pandemic. And really, if you think about it, there's never a zero risk situation when you're gathering. There are always communicable diseases around, and it's really just a matter of statistics right now, right? And we are inherently social creatures, and we should not feel guilty for wanting to be with others that we love and cherish in person. It doesn't make us bad people. In fact, there's so much sadness and anxiety. You know, we want that more than ever right now.
Let's go straight to the phones because people are calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to share the choices that you've made, how you feel about social gatherings and parties, reactions to what's happening in your community. We've got Andrew on the line from Boston. Andrew, go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I have canceled my wedding, which was supposed to be on October 25th. My best man's from California. My fiance's family's from Michigan. Having a regular wedding right now is just socially irresponsible. We were hoping to have Jack the Whipper perform and do entertaining, but we're, again, being responsible. So as somebody who has literally canceled his own wedding, I feel like I'm in a better position than most to say that what these people are doing in Maine and elsewhere is utterly irresponsible and, my opinion, unforgivable. There's no excuse for it. Thank you.
Andrew, I'm sorry that you had to cancel your wedding. Before you go, have you thought about how to reschedule it, or are you just going to wait?
You know, we thought about having one of these quote-unquote mini-monies that have become the trend with a smaller group. But the bottom line is we both have big families. We all have lots of friends. And however we have tried to plan it alternately, it just didn't feel right. So we are going to delay things approximately 1 year and get married then. And look, if there's not a vaccine by then and we still have to reschedule, we might have to do something else. But for the time being, we're pushing it down a year to do it the way we want and in a way that is both safe and socially responsible.
Andrew, thanks for that. I appreciate it. Beth, let's give you a chance to react. I mean, that seems to be in the vein of what you were just saying.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping you were going to come to me. I was thinking about these mini-monies, which I love that phrase. I hadn't heard that before, that term. I talked to a wedding planner who said that people are having these little, you know, micro-weddings or mini-monies and asking guests to quarantine 14 days ahead before coming to the wedding, which I was thinking, on one hand, guests were being saved a lot of time because of the pandemic, because weddings used to now recently have spread to 2 or 3 days with the before, you know, cocktails and after brunch. And now it's just like down to 3 hours. But if you've got a quarantine for 14 days ahead before going to an event, that really puts, you know, you're really in it as a guest. Yeah, I think he's smart because people who do have, you know, big families or want to celebrate in a certain way, I think you want to just maybe get married if you want, you know, officially, just as a piece. But then have a big party later. I think that's probably the way to do it. I was also thinking if I could just talk about the parties in the parties, or maybe you want to get to that later, like the one in February, where the police charged the parents, those parents and their teenager with criminal for hosting that large party. I was interested to learn that there was so much vitriol flowing to the couple on social media that authorities were actually urging the people to accept the fact that these people were being charged criminally so you can leave them alone online. Like, people are really getting angry at people who violate these policies.
We actually spoke with civil liberties attorney Harvey Silverglate yesterday about that specifically, because it led to a delay in in-person learning for 2 weeks at Lincoln Sudbury High School. Here's what he said. He said it. He doesn't. Okay, so let me backtrack. The charge is under the host law, which is about underage drinking. And he was saying he doesn't think it was underage drinking that made the police take action. Here he is.
I think it was a combination of the underage drinking, but more importantly, it was the gathering without face masks in close proximity, without social distancing, of a group of people during a pandemic, where the governor has issued orders prohibiting such gatherings.
Dr. Durone, how do you feel about the possibility of beginning to use law enforcement in these ways, either with existing statutes or, you know, bringing in the new mandates from the governor to regulate behavior during the pandemic?
Yeah, I'm sort of two minds about that. I mean, I agree with the caller that having a big wedding, especially when it violates local law or local guidance, is irresponsible. That, you know, statistically, the more people you have, the more likely there is to be someone with COVID there. And when people gather, especially in a crowded room, especially indoors, talking loudly, yelling in each other's ears, they are going to spread, you know, the virus. On the other hand, I do worry that what we've seen in the past is that, you know, heavy-handedness, laws, preaching, shaming don't really work when it comes to public health initiatives. And, you know, we've seen that with things like HIV and condom use, that, you know, acting like you know better than the public about what the public should do doesn't really play well.
I'd like to go to the phones here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have Elizabeth on the line from Melrose. Elizabeth.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. My father passed away about a week and a half ago, and we did decide to go ahead with a service. We had an outdoor service at the grave and invited people to come. Everyone wore masks, and we decided, you know, and stayed apart. And we made the decision not to have a gathering afterward to have food and celebrate his life. But we did bring refreshments actually to the cemetery, and people did stay so that they could talk and support each other. It felt very important to celebrate his life and to be together. Two of my siblings could not come because they are from out of state, and they made the decision to not come. But it was good to do that, and it really did, it did help sort of put some closure on a really difficult experience.
Elizabeth, thank you for sharing your story, and I'm really sorry for your loss. I hope your grief I hope you get some relief from your grief. We have a second call that's on a similar subject, and I actually think maybe even Elizabeth's call might help Cynthia in the Boston Seaport District. Cynthia, you go ahead.
Hi. Yes, we had a young family member pass away at the very beginning of the COVID crisis, not of COVID, of ovarian cancer at 31 years old. And I'm just curious, you know, if you have any advice. We did end up having services for her in New Hampshire, but there was a lot of angst and concern by many family members about attending it. Concern, you know, for her parents who really needed some closure, but concern.
We lost Cynthia there. Cynthia, I'm sorry that we lost you, but I think we got a sense of what your question is. And I hear that angst, which I think is so deeply seated. Beth, have you heard other examples of this? Cynthia's looking for advice. Have you heard other ways people are handling these moments of grief and loss?
Oh, I'm so sorry for both of you. That's just so hard. And of course, with someone with a death, it's so hard. I have spoken to people who have gotten comfort by calling loved ones on the phone and really talking to them to have a big Zoom conversation. I participated in that with a remembrance of somebody's life who died a year earlier, a nice Zoom group thing where we all said nice things about the woman who had died and really thought about her together. Of course, it's certainly not like being there in person, but seeing everybody's face on the screen and everybody had thought about things to say ahead of time did feel meaningful.
Dr. Durone, have hospitals come up with ways that they are supporting or guiding people, giving recommendations about grieving when a loved one's been lost?
Well, you know, I think, no, I mean, I don't, that's a good point. I think we don't have a one-size-fits-all recommendation for how to handle grief and loss in the time of a pandemic. I think, you know, the first caller described her outdoor ceremony or gathering and with, you know, with mask wearing, and that's exactly what we want people to do. You know, people should feel that they can safely gather when they need that emotional support of in-person, time spent together outside in the appropriate size gathering and with masks on. That is relatively safe. And one should not be made to feel an additional, you know, there's enough sadness and grief and anxiety over the loss and the times that we're in, and one should not be made to feel an additional layer of guilt and shame over the gathering itself, because it is within the guidance. The we are lucky that we live in a state here in Massachusetts where the administration, the Baker administration, uses science and medical experts to guide him on the definition of appropriate gathering sizes, and there's no need to feel that one has to go beyond that, although individuals can choose not to attend if they are concerned about their own health.
Dr. Duron, Beth Tytel, stay with us for a minute. I want to bring in another voice for just a minute. We've got Jackie Murphy on the line, who is the Director of Public Health at the Milford Board of Health. Jackie, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Jackie, we wanted to talk to you because Milford recently fined a homeowner $1,500 for hosting a party that nearly 200 people attended. Just very briefly, Jackie, what happened and how did you make the decision to issue a fine?
Yeah, great question. So they had a large gathering, and actually 200 is a conservative estimate of how many people were there. And we had been getting reports after these types of gatherings, but no one was reporting them at the time. So I think that's an important thing to note. If there's no evidence and there, you know, aren't enough people making enough noise, then the police don't respond. So in this case, the police responded to this event and asked the group to disperse. And thankfully, you know, everyone did very peacefully and cooperatively. So the way we kind of looked at it is, of course, public health is all about education and getting people kind of on board with understanding why these laws are in place, especially during a pandemic. So we spoke to the homeowner and also issued a fine. And our thinking here was, you know, these evidence-based policies, like Dr. Duron was talking about, around how people can safely gather are worth enforcing. They show everyone that we care about them, and that's kind of what we came to our conclusion with.
And Jackie, what has the public response been? If in general, in Milford, has the community been supportive of your decision to place this fine?
In general, yes. I think someone else before talked about the social contract and kind of all of us being in this together, and this time is about collectively trying to prevent illness. And so in general, a lot of people, you know, who had made sacrifices of their own, like some of the earlier callers, canceling their own events or gatherings, or postponing them rather, they were appreciative that, you know, rules are rules, and if I'm bothering to follow the rules, then I want to see that people who are not taking them seriously, you know, they get educated, and also there are consequences that are meaningful.
Well, Jackie Murphy, I appreciate you taking out the time. That's Jackie Murphy, who is the Director of Public Health at the Milford Board of Health. Thank you.
Of course.
And let's grab a couple of calls briefly before we turn back to Dr. Duron and Beth Tytel. We've got John on the line from Northborough. John, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I own an off-premise catering business with my wife, and we had 90 weddings booked at the beginning of the season, and nearly all 90 either canceled or postponed or what have you. Lately, we've been doing the smaller 15, 20, 25, depending on outside or inside weddings. And every time I send a crew out, I tell you, I'm for a week, I'm holding my breath that none of my staff have been exposed. It's a terrifying thing that you know, from a hospitality industry to send your staff out, you know, and you know, hope that the guests are going to be respectful and everybody's going to do the right thing. But it's, you know, our business may not survive this, obviously. But it's terrifying times for caterers.
John, that's tough. And I really appreciate you calling and telling us your story. It brings home, Dr. Duron, I mean, we have a positivity rate across the Commonwealth on whole under 1%. We do have some communities with higher rates up in the 5% range. How fearful should people be after coming into contact with people who are celebrating, and maybe some of them are observing the appropriate social distancing, but some aren't? Is this a time to be that kind of afraid for a week or 2 weeks afterward?
Well, you know, of course, it really does depend on your level of vulnerability, your underlying comorbidities, your age, and all of those things. You want to take all of the precautions. You don't want to be hanging out within 6 feet of someone for more than 15 minutes. You know, those are the things, time and proximity are the things that are going to increase your risk. We're increasingly finding that it's likely that mask wearing doesn't just protect others, but it may also protect you. And so if you're taking all of those precautions, with the very, very low rates of infection here in Massachusetts, it is likely that you can do that. You can work in the catering business, or you can attend small outdoor gatherings without much risk.
Let's grab one more call here. We have Janice from Waltham. Janice, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I had a big birthday, 60, in early September, and I realized I couldn't do what I planned to do. So after a lot of thought, I decided to just write a note to my 40 closest friends and ask them each if they'd like to either take me out to a restaurant with an outdoor patio or come over and bring a dessert and sit on my deck 12 feet apart. And it's been wonderful. 25 different people have done it, and one at a time. And so it's taken a lot of time. It's been 6 weeks of partying, and it's just been the most wonderful thing because I got to have individual time with each one, and some I had not seen since before COVID. So it just was the most wonderful birthday ever.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, Janice. Thank you. And let me turn to you, Beth. You know, 6 weeks straight of the people who care about you the most celebrating you sounds like a good thing. Are there things that will change permanently about how we socialize and celebrate?
You know, I absolutely love that. You mentioned that you reached out to 40 people. I think you had 25. If you expand that, you could basically keep this going till your 61st birthday. You'd be like cake and dessert brought to you every day, and then the restaurants. I love the idea because a lot of people, I was thinking about something related to this. A lot of people obviously have holiday parties, and, you know, I doubt that's going to be happening unless you're given like a time slot of when you can enter the holiday party. You can have two hors d'oeuvres from 8:07 to 8:15. I love the idea of kind of meeting with people individually, like in your backyard. I know a lot of people are getting heat lamps, although of course those are selling out, but doing maybe
yes,
even starting earlier, like, you know. So I think that just meeting, really saying, okay, a big group isn't going to work, but let me actually take the opportunity to talk to those people individually. Usually at a party, you feel so rushed anyway. This is actually could be a great thing.
I think we will wrap it there. I'm sorry for the calls that we didn't get to. This is an important conversation, and one that as we head into the holidays, we will undoubtedly have again. Beth Tytel, reporter for the Boston Globe, thanks for joining us to have this chat today.
Oh, thanks.
And Dr. Shira Derone, who is an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, thanks to you as well for joining us.
Thank you.
That chill in the morning air means that it is time to put up stores for the winter. And with so many of us spending more time at home and with pandemic gardens in full bloom, at-home pickling products have become the new paper towels. There's a shortage of jars and lids. Here's how Marisa McClellan, author of the blog Food in Jars, put it to NPR.
Almost every day I get a note on Instagram like, hey, I'm having a hard time finding the lids for canning jars. Do you know where I might find them? And then each time having to break the bad news to them that everyone's struggling.
So it's safe to say that a lot of people are giving pickling, preserving, jams a try this year. Are you one of them? If so, do you have any questions? Or maybe you're wondering how to get started. Maybe you have a story of success or failure that you'd like to tell us about. Any or, you know, other at-home food products that you're experimenting with, trying out for the first time. Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. So with us to pickle, jam, and preserve today are Travis Grillo, the owner of the Boston-based Grillo's Pickles. Travis started Grillo's Pickles in 2008, selling pickles off a wooden pickle cart on the streets of Boston. Now Grillo's is a 10,000 stores nationwide distributor. Travis, welcome.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And Julia Hallman, who is the lead buyer at Formaggio's Kitchen, where she teaches about canning, jamming, and pickles. Julia, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you both. Travis, I'm going to start with you. You started Grillo's Pickles. That was after pickling had been an actual family activity for you. Why do you like to pickle things?
Well, for me, it was something that I didn't get a job at Nike. So it was kind of another creative way to, you know, do something that I didn't have a job and I wanted to make some money. So I rolled out the first pickle car ever in Boston and started selling two spears for a dollar on the street. And it took off until now, you know, it's a national brand. So it was just something creative, something different. And I use a lot of my design background into the pickling process to spread the word around Boston.
Travis, you may win the award for most surprising answer of the week with "I sell pickles because I didn't get a job at Nike." I love that. I love that. So, Julia, you moved to Boston from Oregon and missed gardening and preserving so much that you actually are making it work from a little apartment. Tell us about that transition here and getting started in the city.
Sure. So, yeah, I grew up on a little farm in eastern Oregon where it was a family tradition to make blackberry jam every season at the end of summer. And then I went to school out at Tufts and realized that I missed all of that sort of homegrown, home-preserved food. And so starting actually even while I was a student, I started my own garden and started preserving as much as I could. And now I have a little bit more space, but still in Cambridge, space is pretty limited. So I've created a little pallet garden so that I can do vertical gardening and preserve as much of the harvest as I can to put up for the winter so that I'm enjoying all of the tomatoes and cherries and plums that I'm able to grow in the summertime throughout the winter.
I just want to remind callers, you can call in 800-423-8255 with your own experiences with pickling or preserving or creating jam or with questions for Travis and Julia. And I want to ask you both, what is your favorite thing that you have pickled or preserved in your own kitchen in, say, the last couple of weeks? Travis, you first.
For me, I've been experimenting with a lot of cabbage. And I've been, you know, not necessarily a kimchi, but more of a light vinegar salted brine. Just another way to preserve cabbage and use it in salads, use it on tacos. It's just another way to utilize the cabbage that most people think you just got to maybe boil. Or, you know, so for me, it's just another way to use it and add spices to the brine, which would be, you know, vinegar and salt and water, but then you could add in turmeric and things, the rosemary or flavors that you like specifically. And it's just a good way to, you know, experiment with is like using cabbages, things like that. And also
so would,
beets.
Would turmeric like and rosemary beets. Taste really good on like cabbage on a taco? That's one of the things that you said, Travis.
Yeah, look, I would use like a cilantro, you know, something a little bit more to the occasion, but it's all about what you like. You know, if you like heat, you can add hot peppers, jalapenos, things like that to spice up the pickling process and to make the vegetable to coordinate with whatever meal you're making.
How about you, Julia? What's your favorite thing you've preserved or pickled or jarred in some way in the last couple of weeks?
Sure. So I always try to experiment every year. One of my old standbys that I love is doing a melon jam. It's a pretty classic jam in Italy, and I had it on the shelves at Formaggio, and I thought, why can't I get this around here? Why don't I ever see it? And so I tried making it, and so over the years, I've been kind of experimenting a bit, fine-tuning the recipe, and basically I wait until I find a melon that's just perfectly sweet, and then I just put that aside for canning. But then we also had our grapevine go absolutely crazy this year, and I, for the first time, pickled grape leaves, because I've always had fond memories of making dolmas with my dad growing up, so I thought that, you know, I might as well keep it all in-house and preserve the grape leaves so that I can do that in the fall and winter when it gets a bit colder.
What kind of melon do you use in the melon jam?
So you can really use anything. For me, one of my favorites is canary melons, which are just bright yellow on the outside and almost a white flesh on the inside. But I've also had amazing results with just a super sweet cantaloupe.
So, Travis, why is this a great moment to either learn how to or step up your game on pickling and preserving, both in terms of the fall and this pandemic moment we're in where people are doing so much more in their own kitchens?
Yeah, I think it's a good way to, you know, A, pass some time, right? Pickling takes time. It takes a few hours. You got to clean your products. You got to prep things. So I think the time can be helpful, right, for the long days and the cold days that we have ahead. So something to keep you busy. But also if you have a family, it's a good way to bring the family together and everybody be interactive and have fun and have laughs. And then you can have competitions where each family member has a different pickle idea, and then you try them in a couple weeks later. So you can just have a lot of fun around it. It's just another way I think the people can have fun with. It's just a great way to preserve things too through your garden so they're not going to waste. So you get a lot of benefits from pickling and spread love. So it's just something that's all positive for me.
Let's grab our first call, 1-800-423-8255. Sasha has a question. Sasha, you're on from Cambridge. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, yes. So I have tried a little bit of pickling and canning in the past, but I'm intimidated by all of the equipment that you're supposed to have, and my kitchen's really small, so I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for substitutes for the equipment, things that you might have around the house so you don't have to buy all new stuff and find a place to put it.
Great question, Sasha. Julia, I'll let you take this one first.
Sure. So that's actually a great question, and I have a lot of experience because I, at one point, lived in a 500-square-foot apartment in Harvard Square, and still did a lot of canning. And one of the really important things for canning when you're doing a water bath is to make sure that the jars don't touch the bottom of the pot, because that helps to prevent breakage from the glass touching a really hot surface. So one hack that I did, because I didn't at that time really have space for a massive canning pot with the sort of apparatus, sort of the canning holder that you put inside there, I just pulled up a kitchen towel and put it at the bottom of a stock pot. Basically anything that you use that's tall enough to give about 1 inch to 2 inches of headroom over that pint-sized jar. And it's a really good hack, so that really it's all materials that you already have. And one of my favorite tools to always have on hand for canning is a jar lifter, and that doesn't take up much space at all. And other than that, you really don't need any other of the specialized equipment to do some basic canning, like making jams or canned tomatoes and things, and pickles and things like that. So that's my advice, is to just kind of work around those with the materials that you have. And then once you get more space, then you can buy the more specialized equipment when you do bigger batches.
So, Travis, I had a Grillo pickle with my lunch today in anticipation of the show, and I have never pickled anything before, but it was tasty. And if I now felt inspired, but as Julia was saying, don't have a lot of equipment and certainly not any skill, how could I start? What's maybe the first thing I could try at home?
Yeah, for me, you know, it's familiar as well, because I started in my apartment in Alston. So for me, I get the pain there. And I think that the best thing to do is to make sure you have, maybe for mine was an extra refrigerator. So I had an extra refrigerator so that way I could have some of my supplies. Now, there was a time I only had one refrigerator. So what did I do? I sacrificed what I ate, right? And I just had more pickles. So there's some sacrificing there. But as far as supplies and stuff, a lot of these things that you need for my type of pickling, which is a cold process, you can find right around in your own home. And if you don't have lids, you could use tin foil and an elastic band and put it in the back of your fridge and still enjoy them. So you could utilize any old containers that you have that other food has come in. So you can utilize those type of things that you already have to do the pickling process. And a lot of, for us, it's cold. So you'd have to have refrigeration to be able to mass produce your pickles if you wanted to do it over a long period of time.
800-423-8255 if you want to tell us your story of the first time you pickled or preserved something in your kitchen. I had a colleague tell me today about an experience that she had where some bottles blew up. So we all have those moments where maybe we tried something and it didn't go right. But what's your experience? Julia, I was just being funny, but it is interesting that we do seem to see people kind of having hunkering down behavior. There is a social phenomenon going on, not only because we're mm-hmm. closed in, but also because the future seems uncertain. Do you think there is a return to this sort of long tradition that's coming from that place?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it too as more of a return to normalcy for myself, because, you know, growing up in a very self-sufficient way where, you know, I hunted for my food, fished for my fish, and grew all the vegetables that we ate. You know, I think it's great to have people realize that the food chain isn't infallible, and that we need to support more of our local producers and local farmers, and also rely more on ourselves. So I think of it more as a positive, where
people are starting to realize that they have a lot of the resources and tools around them. They've just never really been taught how to use them properly. And so now with this pandemic, people are giving the time, the knowledge, the information, and with the local farmers being really some of the only people who are continuing the supply chain during sort of the panic buying that happened in the beginning, they're now getting better access to these great local ingredients if they don't have room to grow their own food. So, yeah, so I think if anything, it's a really, really great return to how important it is to kind of look a little bit closer to home for what's important with what you consume.
And Travis, in doing some reading on that subject, I saw, you know, articles about people preserving and canning even like meat, like poultry, et cetera. What are maybe some of the surprising things that we can either pickle or preserve, you know, this time of year?
I think something that's, you know, watermelon rinds and some of the waste that people use, even carrot shreds and things that people just throw away. Again, like what Julia said, it's like getting back to basics, and I think people are utilizing that. So, you know, instead of throwing things in the garbage, sometimes you could throw them in brine and salt and use them on a dish 4 days from now that has a great topping now. So, you know, like a watermelon rind, really good to pickle, and it tastes good, and you can make it sweet. You can add mint, fresh mint. So there's all these things like that that I think have a longevity if you can get it, you know, get it done.
I think I might give the last word to a call. We've got Russ on the line from Winchendon. Russ, go ahead.
Driving. I'm going to pull over here. I have... quick recipe for Thai style namprik nampla, which is hot peppers and fish sauce. It's not very American, and it's not very pickled. You don't have to cook it. You just chop cayenne peppers or Thai dragons, eighth of an inch to quarter of an inch long. Maybe mince some garlic, some shallots. I like a little bit of ground black pepper or powdered white pepper, and soak the whole thing in Southeast Asian fish sauce and cap it tightly because it smells. Americans don't like that smell.
All right, Russ, thanks for that recipe. We appreciate it. And we are actually, I think I'm going to have to give Russ the last word there. I think this is something we'll probably want to do some work with again. I appreciate the time today. That was Travis Grillo, the owner of Boston-based Grillo's Pickles, which is in 10,000 stores nationwide. Travis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Julia Hallman, lead buyer at Formaggio's Kitchen, where she teaches about canning, jamming, and pickles. Julia, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. And in the meantime, let's go out today on Courtney Barnett's Pickle from the Jar.